All right, good afternoon, everybody. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, ITRC Vapor Intrusion Mitigation Session 2. My name is Sarah Levy. I'm going to be your moderator today, and I'm coming at you live from Washington, D.C. This training is an introduction to the ITRC online technical resources for vapor intrusion mitigation produced by ITRC in 2021. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Let's cover some of our housekeeping rules for today. This training is going to be recorded and will be offered on demand through CLUIN for those not able to join us live. The CLUIN training page offers the slides for you to download under the Download Training Materials as well. Please use the Q&A box to answer questions, make comments, or report technical problems at any time. We will have a question and answer break about halfway through the training, as well as at the end of today's modules. For those of you that are interested in receiving certificates of completion, that will be available upon the completion of the feedback form. Once you complete the form and click the box to certify that you participated, that certificate will be provided to you. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you are participating in today. If you'd like to be a part of the ITRC, please visit the ITRC website. On our website, you can register for Teams and learn more about how you can become an active member at ITRC. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website as well. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we do ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the US government, and ITRC nor the US government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. On this slide, I have the pleasure of introducing all of our trainers for today. They have all served as members of the Vapor Intrusion Mitigation Team and volunteer to support the training offered today. And now I'm going to pass it off to Kelly Johnson from North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality to orient us all for the training. Welcome, Kelly.
Oh, thank you so much, Sarah. Yeah, welcome everybody to the session two, the ITRC VI mitigation training. It's going to be a good session. Let's see here. Make sure my slides work. But today, what you should learn, we'll do a quick background on the Vapor Intrusion Mitigation Training Team. We'll talk about an overview of the available documentation. We'll talk about how to access the mitigation strategies, and we'll identify the sections that'll be discussed today. So the sections for today, like I said, it's a good lineup here: active mitigation, passive mitigation, and system OM&M operations, maintenance, management, and exit strategies. Sorry, there we go. All right. On the bottom right of the page here is a web link, and for throughout this entire session, I highly encourage you to have that kind of pulled up. And inside that link, if you click on the interactive directory button, I believe it's on the left side, you'll see this figure on the right. And each one of those boxes on the right is actually a clickable document. And the idea was to try and help organize this material to get to it fast. And there's also on each one of those documents, there should be a link to go back to the document map. So you should be able to jump between the two. And like I said, I highly encourage you to kind of have that up so that you can get to some of these documents as the trainers are talking about each of these sections. And so part of this, we made the interactive directory. We made fact sheets for all the topics you see over there. There's technology information sheets with additional details on some of the technologies. Inside the CSM module that was in session one, you can get the recording for that if you need. There's a really good flow chart for the vapor intrusion CSM development. There's also considerations and impacts of the various vapor intrusion mitigation approaches. There's checklists, which we'll also cover later today, and then there's additional information. And like I said, I highly encourage you to kind of have that, the ITRC VIM webpage pulled up. Just a quick reminder on vapor intrusion. Again, vapor intrusion occurs when contaminants in the soil and groundwater volatilize into soil gas. And vapor intrusion itself occurs when these vapors migrate upward into the overlying buildings and contaminate indoor air. There's two primary types of vapor intrusion. There's chlorinated vapor intrusion, which addresses the chlorinated compounds, and petroleum vapor intrusion, which is a subset of VI that deals exclusively with petroleum hydrocarbons. Now, a lot of plumes will have a mixture of the two, or might just be one of those, and your mitigation approach will change based on what your site COCs are. In vapor intrusion mitigation itself, you implement it to reduce indoor air contaminants due to vapor intrusion. That's an important caveat there, below applicable action or screening levels. And this can be accomplished by modifying the VI pathway to reduce the max flux of contaminants entering the building, and reducing indoor air contaminant concentrations by removal, so rerouting the vapors around the structure. Dilution, adding makeup air, and then also diffusion, adding like a vapor barrier to your structure. And we'll talk in more detail on the coming sections on that. And so, what does vapor intrusion mitigation and control really entail? So, there's a couple different types. You've got source remediation, where you're going to target the source of the contaminants themselves, where the vapors are generated. You've got active or passive mitigation, which occurs at the building envelope between the structure and the subsurface. Rapid response, which is typically implemented to buy you time to get active or passive mitigation approaches implemented. And institutional controls, which place legal or regulatory requirements on a property to prevent exposure. And institutional controls, rapid response, and the remediation parts we covered in session one, 2 weeks ago. You can get that recording. And then today we're going to talk about the active and passive mitigation. This is just a really generalized process of the vapor intrusion mitigation process here. And it's really important for the coming sections to keep in mind. And this is pretty generalized, but you'll see at least be exposed to this real quickly, and then in the coming sections it'll start to make more sense, and especially some of the importance of it. So you've got the pre-system installation, which is an assessment of the site conditions, technology selection, and then you've also got to develop and document your system design. And depending on where you are in the country, or your regulatory requirements, you may have to submit those for review and approval. So make sure you coordinate that. The system installation itself, there's a pre-construction meeting, which cannot be stressed enough to make sure you've got everybody on board, from the plumbers to the pest control people if they're spraying stuff. I mean, everybody needs to be on board for your approach at a site. And throughout it as well, because especially for new construction, you'll see that crews will typically trail off and come in later. You've got the installation itself and installation oversight to make sure that you're overseeing each and every component of the vapor intrusion mitigation system and documenting as well. And so the post-system installation, you've got system verification, more inspections, verification sampling, which could include indoor air, subslab soil gas sampling, and then confirming performance QA/QC, so like a pilot test and looking at your influence. And again, we'll talk about these in more detail coming up. Of course, documentation, make sure you've got all your inspection documentation, field notes and photographs, everything together, especially as needed for your regulatory agency if you're doing it for them. And the long-term stewardship, the operation, maintenance, and monitoring. And so, like I said, I just hopefully kind of keep some of these generalized steps in your mind as the next sections come up. And thank you so much. I'm going to hand it off here for the active mitigation approaches.
Thanks, Kelly. So we'll be jumping right into active mitigation. Lots to cover here today. See if I can, there we go. I've got control. So We're going to start off talking about what defines active mitigation, what makes that different from other technologies. Then we're going to talk about a technology overview, so the common techniques used for mitigation, and those are also techniques that have tech sheets available. And then design considerations. So what are the things we need to look at in creating a design for an active mitigation system? What things need to be documented? So active mitigation is really defined by primarily by the fan, that having an electric powered fan or blower that's continuously moving vapors. And it's continuously moving vapors where we want them to go, right? It's preventing vapors from entering the building by capturing them and then diverting them out and discharging them at a safe location. So it's very it's a very good and reliable system. It's been shown for many years, way back to the radon world as well, where it's a very effective means of mitigation. Another benefit of active mitigation is that there are quantifiable ways that we can measure the performance. Differential pressure, of course, is a common way of measuring performance for a sub-slab depressurization system. There are other lines of evidence that can be used for various techniques, and we'll kind of go through some of those. But concentration-based measurements, mass flux or reductions in sub-slab concentrations, flow rates and vacuums in the system can be used to monitor performance as well. So we have an active mitigation fact sheet, as Kelly kind of pointed out, and some of the tools that were put together. This is sort of the backbone. And then there are also the tech sheets that are referred to here in the fact sheet. And then the fact sheet also refers quite a bit to the ANSI/ARST mitigation standards. They're actually going through a rename. Indoor Air Environments is the new name of that organization. But they put out the more nuts and bolts, in the weeds, how do you design a system? And so there's quite a few references in here to those standards as well. Okay, so the first tech sheet that we're going to talk about is sub-slab depressurization. And of course, here basically the premise is we're going to flip-flop the pressure gradient across the slab. So we're going to make it so it's more negative in the sub-slab than in indoor air, and that's going to prevent vapors from entering. You could have some pretty high concentrations of vapors, but once you cut that off, that pathway off by reversing that pressure gradient, those vapors can no longer enter. So very, very effective. Again, there's good ways to measure the effectiveness, differential pressure being kind of the primary one for sub-slab depressurization. Another part of that installation is sealing of cracks, expansion points, openings, preferential pathways like utility conduits. Those will all help that system work better, help increase radius of influence and prevent anything from getting in through a preferential pathway. So we see a couple of examples here of different systems. So the residential system utilizing a radon fan and looks pretty much exactly like a radon system. And then you see a commercial system, a larger building where a larger blower is being used to try to get some larger radiuses of influence. Some cases, those will operate at higher vacuum levels to really make it a little more feasible to cover the larger spaces that need to be covered in some of these buildings. But the fan or blower is really the heart and soul. That's what's doing the work. That's what's moving the vapors. The suction point is an important feature as well, how that is installed and configured, which is really what's that's where the magic happens, right? That's where the fan is imparting that vacuum influence on the subslab. And then there's various measurement equipment, of course, to measure those parameters we talked about, vacuum gauges. And then with some of these systems where we are on on-site buildings and there are higher concentrations, we might need to do emissions control. So that's a really important consideration, when we're dealing with the higher concentrations, that in many cases we cannot just discharge to the environment. We need to do treatment and we need to do air permitting for many of these systems. In those cases, the equipment may look a lot like an SVE equipment. regenerative blower, knockout tank, air filters, all of that in order to be able to get the vacuum influence we need and also be able to push through the carbon treatment. So some of these can get to be a little bit more complex for some of the larger buildings. New construction is another situation where active systems can be a really good choice. So a lot of times historically we think about passive systems with new construction, but there can be some benefits of an active system as well, and going straight to an active system and kind of maybe not going down that passive pathway. So the gravel is going to be a big benefit. If you get gravel specified for the subslab material, that's going to give you some good permeability. It's going to allow you to remove vapors and move air with the smaller fans. So even in some of these larger buildings in a new construction situation, instead of going with that SVE style system, you could potentially use a radon fan system just to pull vapors through that gravel. So that's a huge potential benefit. Also understanding where there are footings and grade beams and planning for being able to cross those is important as well. And then if you do go straight to active, you're going to hear in the next module about some of the passive VI barriers that are out there and available. If you go active straight off the bat, you can kind of bypass that, go with just a high quality poly barrier. And there can be some cost saving advantages there as well. So it is an option to go straight to active in new construction. And you know, those factors we just talked about, being able to use fans, and can really save a lot of money and really just set yourself up for success. So if it is a new building situation, definitely want to get involved during the building process or during the planning of the building and be able to install those measures and make sure we're being set up for success and reaping that cost benefit. Next one is subslab ventilation. So this is one we want to talk about, spend a little bit of time on. It's we're going to use sort of similar to SSDS, but what's going to happen here is we've got such a high permeability that our system is going to operate, and it may not show some of these strong differential pressure numbers that we see with the subslab depressurization system. You might go to your building and say, I'm going to install a subslab depressurization system, and then lo and behold, find out, well, actually, in fact, it's going to be a subslab ventilation system because there's just too much permeability, not enough resistance to flow to generate those vacuum numbers that are used to determine the success of a subslab depressurization system. And that's okay. Subslab ventilation can be very, very effective. The graphic you see here shows an actual void space under the slab. Yeah. Even in some existing buildings, we'll run across void spaces where soils have settled and so forth. So, if you do have a void space or a very permeable loose gravel, in some cases your system might be functioning as a subslab ventilation system. These systems will tend to operate at higher flow rates, much higher than many of the subslab depressurization systems will operate at. And with that being the case, there's a lot of opportunity for reduction in concentrations, dilution, and just removal of vapors. So these systems will tend to operate at a high flow rate, and in a lower vacuum. So we see an example here of a new construction situation where some forms are being placed that are going to create that void space for the subslab ventilation system. Sometimes you can have even fresh air inlets installed into that layer to kind of help create that flushing in the subslab and that dilution and reduction in subslab concentrations. And so here, you know, really, we're looking at measuring of concentrations potentially as opposed to differential pressure to determine effectiveness of the system. So, we're going to throw a knowledge check at you right off the bat here. A couple scenarios. Scenario A is going to have a gravel subbase, and scenario B has native soils in the subbase. Which of these conditions would be more likely to operate as a subslab venting system? So give you just a moment here. I'm pretty sure this should be pretty quick. And yep, it looks like we got a lot of good response here for scenario A, which is the correct answer. So when we have a more permeable condition in the subslab, that's going to be more likely to operate as a subslab venting system. And we're going to show you one more example of that. So in this scenario, what we're seeing is the purple circle is showing differential pressure measurements, which are meeting a set criteria. But then if we step out farther, we can use other lines of evidence to possibly show that we're moving vapors from a larger radius and actually providing protection over a larger radius. So what I would add to this list would be subslab vapor concentrations, right? So if we can show that at the edge of this larger purple circle that we're meeting subslab criteria, we've reduced concentrations to below subslab criteria, then we can say, okay, well, there's no risk, right? So we've flushed enough vapors through that subslab venting is the function that's happening and providing protection over the larger area. This allows us to design for less suction points, which is a huge advantage. What we really don't want to have to do is over-design systems. And when we have to over-design systems to meet some of these differential pressure requirements, you can imagine how many of these little circles it would take to fill up this building, versus how many of the larger circles it would take to fill up the building. So it's a big difference in how much infrastructure needs to be installed, as well as is how much electricity is needs to be used and what size fans and blowers are needed. So electricity usage is directly related to how hard the blower has to pull. So we can move a lot of air. We can move a lot of CFM of air with very little electricity usage. But when we have to pull really hard to do that, that's where the electricity usage starts to add up and the cost of operating that system starts to add up. Okay, so on to crawl spaces. So primarily we're normally talking about crawl spaces when we're talking about dirt floor areas. We're going to talk about two different ways to address crawl spaces. The first being the preferred approach by far. And this is submembrane depressurization. So here we're really trying to mimic sub-slab depressurization by installing a membrane, right? So we install a membrane. Now we can pull air from under that membrane, and we're functioning in very much the same manner as we would with a sub-slab depressurization system. That by doing that, we're preventing the vapors from getting into the crawl space. The other option, oh, sorry, I'm jumping ahead just a little bit. Here's a photo of what that might look like. You're still using a fan or blower. In this case, it might operate under a little bit different parameters, a little higher flow, perhaps. You've got the barrier that you've securely installed and sealed up as best as you can, and then extracting vapors from underneath that. So the other option is crawl space ventilation. And so here, what happens is the vapors actually enter the crawl space, and that crawl space gets used kind of as a plenum. Vapors enter the crawl space, and then they're captured by the system and removed. So we're still controlling the flow of vapors, where they're going, preventing them from entering the house. But in this case, they have to enter the crawl space first before we can remove them. So that makes it a less attractive option. If there's any way we can get in there and install the barrier or the membrane, we want to do that. This would really be used in cases where we can't get in there and install the membrane. It's just too shallow of a crawl space, or for some other reason, it's not safe to enter. So in that case, we would just stub the pipe in, something like you see here, and then route those vapors to the outdoors. The other thing here is you're probably not going to be measuring differential pressure, right? You don't have a barrier or a slab to measure that. Here you're maybe looking at something like air changes, right? How many air changes per hour am I achieving? So you're measuring flow in that pipe, how much air is being extracted, and looking at what the volume of the space is to come up with those types of evaluations. All right, so on to the design process. And we're going to take a quick look at our view here. We see there's a design considerations fact sheet, and that's what we're going to kind of dive into next. So the design considerations fact sheet, again, it provides a very good overview of the design process. In some of the considerations we'll go through here that are mentioned in that fact sheet. So, kind of going back to that new construction scenario first, when we go to design a system for new construction, obviously the building isn't there yet, right? So we can't go out to the building and do a site visit and look at the things we would normally look at. In this case, we're going to try to get our hands on the construction drawing set. And really, I would encourage getting getting a hold of the entire set. There's a lot of good information in there. It's a little bit of wading through, but there's information in there about where do the HVAC system intakes, where are those going to be placed? Are there going to be some preferential pathways like utility conduits that are coming up from below the slab that we would want to install seal-offs on? A lot of different information we can glean. Where are the grade beams going to be? Are there going to be grade beams that are going to kind of chop up the footprint for us and that we're going to need to make sure we're able to extract from either side of? So a lot of really good information there that we can help inform us on how we want to approach the design for the mitigation system. And then conversely with the existing building, yeah, we need to go get our boots on the ground, take a close look. If we can get a hold of as-built drawings, that's fantastic. We want to do that and look for some of those same things, particularly grade beams and things like that that are going to impact our ability to propagate vacuum. But we can also get out in the field and take a look too, and there'll be things we can look for to try to understand where are their building additions, what are all the different foundation types? Is there a crawl space hidden away somewhere that maybe doesn't jump out at you? What's the slab integrity? Are there openings, which is almost always yes, right? Expansion joints, cracks. Where are those located? Preferential pathways, again, we can look for, utility conduits and things like that. Understanding what's going on with the HVAC system, how is that going to impact our differential pressure measurements is important. How big is this building? And then also, what type of aesthetics is this a historical building or are there going to be some kind of requests about where things get put? Being able to work with building owners on those types of things as well. So once we've got the recon done, we can start to think about the pilot test. Typically with an existing building, we're most times going to want to do a pilot test and really want to do a pilot test in each of the different building addition areas to the extent possible so that maybe you do have a newer addition that's got gravel under it that's going to function much differently than the older parts of the building that were built on clay. And so each of those building additions may have some different properties that we need to understand. And so we'll do that. We'll extract. We usually will do like a step test, try to understand what's the lowest applied vacuum level that's going to give us the best radius of influence or sometimes referred to as PFE. We're going to take the differential pressure measurements and really understand, it's a direct measurement of what type of radius of influence we're getting. We also, this photo shows a shop vac. There's other pieces of equipment that we might want to consider using for that that might give us even better results for different flow and vacuum combinations. So different, those are also some considerations. And then once we get all of this data collected, we understand it, we're going to start to put together our documentation. So we want to put together our basis of design, which is normally going to be based on that pilot test results. What is the radius of influence? What spacing are we going to use? Where can we put a riser pipe in the building? Different things like that. And then we're going to get all that put onto our construction drawing set. We're going to be thinking about what permits need to be collected. And again, air discharge permits are on the table, as well as building permits, electrical permits. Need to understand early in the design process if we are going to do off-gas treatment so that we can design that system appropriately. So we have a big enough blower that can accommodate that off-gas treatment. And then, finishing the set, the specifications, finishing that bid package with all the drawings. And then when we get to the actual construction, making sure we're doing construction quality assurance, making sure we're out there doing the field recon, making sure things are being installed as they were designed to be installed. And then finally getting into the operation O&M. And after the remediation is done, of course, the exit strategy. So those are some topics that'll be discussed more later today. So as part of that design fact sheet, there is also a checklist that goes with that, and that's going to help guide through a lot of those things we just talked about. It's a pretty broad checklist. There's probably going to be some things on there that maybe don't apply to your site. And that's okay. So don't worry about that. But certainly it can help guide through that process and making sure we're thinking about all the different things that we need to be looking at as part of the design. So just a quick summary. We've talked about the definition of the active mitigation system and how the fan or blower is really the differentiator there and really actively pulling those vapors away from the slab or membrane and getting them directed where we want them to go outside. We talked about some common approaches for active mitigation. We talked about some of the design considerations and key elements in that design, and then the documentation that needs to be put together to move that forward. So yeah, just next steps, obviously get it installed and get into doing your O&M. And those topics, like I said, will be covered in the next modules. So we're ready for questions.
So much, Rachel. We are going to open it up for our first question and answer break. At this time or at any time, you can type any questions that you have into the Q&A pod in the bottom of your screen. And we're going to try to get through as many questions as we can. So if you have questions, please put them in the Q&A pod now. We would be more than happy to answer those live here while we have all of our trainers with us. We'll give it a moment to see if we have any questions come through to us because it doesn't look like we have any right now. All right, here we go. We just got our first question. So trainers, any of you are welcome to just, step up and answer this one. But our question is, what are the challenges for crawl space depressurization systems?
Yeah, well, just getting into the crawl space, right, is a big challenge. Being able to work safely in a crawl space, some of them are pretty tight quarters and potential for hazards to be present. So that's definitely a challenge. If you're going to do a submembrane depressurization system, being able to work in there and get a membrane sealed up is certainly challenging and requires some time and effort to do that.
All right, great. Thank you.
I would add one thing. This is Ali. You may also want to consider if you don't have a membrane, you can just push the air inside the crawl space so that you have the air circulation. The other thing that I have tried and has worked is instead of crawl space depressurization, is pressurization, which means you are pushing air in and you let it go out. So basically, you're ventilating the crawl space, and that too may work.
Okay, great. Thank you both. Our next question is, how do you determine the number of suction points?
Yeah, that's going to be, well, in an existing building, that's going to be based on the pilot test results, right? So you're going to determine with your differential pressure measurements how big a radius of influence you're able to achieve, and that's going to determine the spacing of the suction points. So within your mitigation area, you're going to usually lay it out just with some circles, kind of like we saw in that one diagram, and so that you get the coverage that you need. Of course, still considering things like where are their grade beams and where are there places I can put a riser pipe. So there are a number of things that go into that, but the primary thing would be the pilot test results. And then for a new construction, there's kind of some standard spacing available again through the NCR documents provide some good recommendations on spacing for riser pipes for new construction.
Thank you. Our next question is, do you have a recommendation for a good detailed PFE procedure slash SOP? I have seen many, but most are very general.
Well, of course, we have, our own here at Arcadis that we would use that would go through that process. So we do things like doing a step test, and we actually will typically use a regen blower so that we can have a large range of flow and vacuum combinations so that we can accommodate if it is a clay that we encounter or something like that. I mean, as far as something that's within, guidance documents, I'm not sure that you would find that, but I think, there are folks that have those types of procedures that they would use.
Thank you. That's great input. Looks like next we are asking, it says, we are seeing intrusion from roof penetrations and HVAC intake systems due to the discharge pipe being too close to these when winds are calm. Is there a rule of thumb to address this?
Yes, absolutely. And NCR's mitigation standards, each of the versions of that address that. Rules of There's definitely some rules of thumb in there. Usually a 10 feet minimum from a vent, but certainly from an active HVAC intake, being a little more conservative is a good policy. More like maybe a 30 feet. And there are some ASHRAE guidance documents that also speak to that and speak to some of those distances for discharges from building intakes.
And next, have you run into problems with crawl space depressurization that also has an active dehumidifier?
I don't believe so. I guess I'm not quite sure what type of issue that's being referred to there.
All right, no worries. We will move on to our next question. Which says, if in addition to a dirt floor slash crawl space, you have a cobblefield stone wall in a basement, would you still recommend some kind of membrane or more permanent cover for mitigation?
Yeah, that's definitely an option to cover that cobbled wall with a membrane for sure. And that would be probably a lot easier than trying to do, any other sealing measures there to prevent vapor entry through the walls. So yeah, covering those walls with a membrane would be a good call.
All right, and next, all right, this one's a little bit long, but it says, are there general suggestions on a mitigation system that can be installed when the building is constructed, is slab on grade, is old occupied and cluttered, and interior access to slab for crack sealing, much less mitigation system install is minimal. Can a system be installed exterior slash adjacent to the building? Like an intercept system?
Yeah, that's a great question. Those slab and grade buildings can be tough. There's a lot of things you can run into there. We've seen things like sub-slab ductwork under slab and grade buildings. Yeah, they're definitely challenging. So thinking outside the box is certainly appropriate there. Whether it's what you're suggesting as far as an intercept type system, not exactly sure the configuration, but yeah, we might have to put the thinking cap on those, because those are definitely much tougher to access and get at that subslab area and fully depressurize it. So yeah, I mean, if you have to do something exterior, definitely. I mean, there's I don't think there's any rule against that, right? Being creative and coming up with a solution there.
Yeah, definitely. All right, we have a lot of questions, but we have plenty of time. So, Rachel, we'll just keep picking your brain here for a few more minutes.
All right.
Our next question says, say that your space under the slab of a building is saturated with water and the SSDS can't be implemented without drawing water, and the floor in the building cannot support a false floor to act as a preferential pathway for vapor mitigation inside the building. How would you actively mitigate the VI pathway as a result of the high water table?
Geez, they're throwing hard ones out today. That's a toughie, right? That's like the worst case scenario that we run into. Dewatering is a potential option, right? Installing like a perimeter drain system, a sump system, basically trying to get that water away from the subslab area. And if you can't do that and you can't put in a false floor, then you're probably looking at a passive measure. Now you're looking at maybe some sort of a coating or something, which is also not easy to implement by any stretch in an existing building. So it's that's those are the toughies, right? Those are the really difficult ones.
Rachel, I'll give you just a little break here. You've been doing a great job answering all these questions.
Thanks.
So for this one, I've had some of these situations. You may also want to consider using if let's say it's not a residence and it's a commercial building and it has a HVAC system, you can use the HVAC system as a substitute for a remedy. That itself has its own pros and cons, but you may want to be more original or innovative in addressing the indoor air. And we have used HVAC system as a substitute for subslab if we cannot do a subslab. We use as a guidance air exchange rate of one, and then we collect indoor samples for confirmation afterwards. The difficulty in that is you want to make sure that the system continues to be operated because it's under the mercy of the building owner and the tenant. And there are ways to do that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, and like in the radon guidance too, they talk about heat recovery ventilators and things like that. So there are some different techniques out there. We talk a lot about subslab depressurization. It's typically considered the preferred technique because we're not having to rely on maintaining indoor air equipment. But certainly there are times where that's needed.
Moving on to our next question. What is the vacuum minimum to define a radio of influence?
Oh, so that's a highly debated question as well, right? So that all depends on how much factor of safety you want to include. So technically, once you've flipped that gradient and you can see like a minus 0.001, which is a water column, you've achieved subslab depressurization, right? The trick is that when you're measuring differential pressures, you're always measuring against the indoor air pressure. And so the fluctuations that we see in those numbers are really fluctuations in the indoor air pressure. So as the building throughout the day, whether it's HVAC kicking on and off or other, effects of weather, wind, other ventilation systems in the building, if you've wind turbines in the attic or attic vents, different things can cause changes in the indoor air pressure. And so most agencies are looking for some sort of a factor of safety on those numbers. Some of them are seasonal, because winter still is, in most cases, not in all climate zones that we have, but in most cases, winter is still considered to be the worst case scenario for the stack effect to be creating negative pressure within the building, particularly in homes. Say HVAC is a little bit different story, and some of the warmer climates have some different factors. But there are a variety of numbers out there in different jurisdictions. So that one is up for a debate on how much factor of safety, should be included. And in some cases that can be tackled too by including things like telemetry. Or doing some logging events where you can show over a 24-hour period, vacuum, you're maintaining vacuum. It may not be a 0.02, but maybe you're still maintaining vacuum. So, yeah, there's a lot of discussion, I think, on that one still out there. But again, it'd be helpful to kind of allow for those types of measurements, the loggers and the telemetry, again, to try to so that we're not over designing systems, using a lot more electricity than we need to generate higher factors of safety than we need to. And so I think that's still something that's maybe a topic in the industry that maybe has some different opinions out there on.
Time for maybe just a few more questions. So we will go with what we have first. What does a tracer test include, and is there any guidance or procedure on that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know that there's any guidance per se. There's probably some papers out there and things that talk about different tracer tests. Essentially, you're looking to see, are you moving vapors from point A to point B? And so we kind of showed that diagram with the circles during the presentation and talked about, if you go out to your monitoring point, maybe you don't measure differential pressure, but maybe you can measure other things. Maybe you can show that a tracer is moving to that area or moving away from that area. Maybe you can take a PID and see that your sub-sub concentrations are changing as you're running your test. So there's different ways to show that you're impacting an area beyond just using differential pressure.
Next, we would like to know if there is any difference in mitigation techniques for radon versus VOCs.
The techniques themselves are very, very similar. I think what happens is that they're judged differently, right? So in some cases, VOC systems are being held to a different standard. And some of the stuff we just talked about, which was what differential pressure number do you hit? In some cases, we see agencies asking for 0.02, minus 0.02 inches of water column. And that's maybe fine to allow you a factor of safety. But what I think there should be some caution on is if you don't hit 0.02, that doesn't mean you're not mitigating, right? So that's something to keep in mind. And radon systems have historically not been held to that. They usually do an indoor air test. Their tests are a little less expensive, and so that's always been how they've judged theirs, as opposed to doing hitting a set differential pressure number. They are looking at that in their industry as well, in the ANSI ARST and indoor air environments guidance documents on doing their PFE checks and making sure that they are getting some differential pressure evidence. But it's not something that they're being held to those standards. So what happens is the VOC systems again end up being over-designed in many cases to hit some of these targets that are maybe not quite necessary always. So I would say that's what makes them different. They tend to use, for that reason, bigger blowers, bigger fans, more electricity, because of the standards that they're being held to. Looks like there was one question. Maybe we skipped over. If you want to go back to that one real quick.
Yeah, I see it right here. When would you use and not use exhaust fans in the occupied spaces to mitigate vapors?
Yeah, I wanted to make sure we answered this one because the answer is never. And the reason being that exhaust fans are depressurizing the indoor air. And so they're going to then draw vapors into the indoor air, right? So exhaust fans are not a good mitigation technique, and especially for an occupied space. And what this would equate to is very similar to what we actually talked about as far as a crawl space ventilation system, where the crawl space becomes a plenum. Vapors enter the crawl space and then they're discharged outside. And that's fine for a crawl space that's unoccupied, but we really don't want to be drawing vapors through an occupied space. So we don't want an exhaust fan pulling vapors into the occupied space.
Thank you so much, Rachel, for clarifying that. With that, we will have more opportunities to ask questions in our second question and answer break, which will come in a little bit. But at this time, I am going to turn this over to Jay Eichberger with Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy, and Peter Grant with EPRO to discuss passive mitigation approaches.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Rachel. I'm Jay Eichberger, and today I'll be discussing passive mitigation along with Peter Grant. Let me see if I can just advance the slide here. We'd like to share the content that our subgroup created. Unfortunately, we can't cover all that content today, so we're going to provide an overview of passive mitigation technologies and the mitigation process. During the first half of the presentation, I will define passive mitigation, introduce you to documents our subgroup created, and discuss common mitigation technologies. During the second half of the presentation, Peter will introduce key considerations for system design, installation, and planning, and end with a discussion of construction quality control measures. At the conclusion of today's presentation, you should be familiar with a range of mitigation technologies, how to select a mitigation approach for your site, and how to ensure proper system installation. But before we continue, I want to remind you to update and review the conceptual site model often. This allows the project team to evaluate whether current site conditions warrant mitigation before proceeding any further. It also ensures that site conditions drive the selection of the mitigation approach, which is critically important. At this point in the site evaluation process, we assume that you've already decided to implement a passive mitigation approach. So let's start with defining passive mitigation. Passive mitigation does not rely on mechanical means, such as radon fans or vacuum blowers, to capture contaminant vapors. And this is done by blocking migration of contaminant vapors using chemical diffusion and relying on natural mechanisms such as pressure gradients to divert contaminant vapors through or around the building envelope. Anytime mitigation is necessary, it's important to gauge with all of the stakeholders. This ensures that the installed mitigation systems are understood and they're not compromised in the future. Simply explaining to the property owner why a vapor mitigation system is needed can go a long way towards keeping that system running in the future. The information we'll be covering today is based on the passive mitigation fact sheet. You can think of this document as your guide to passive mitigation approaches. It walks the reader through the mitigation process from start to finish, and it directs the reader to additional technical resources. The passive mitigation fact sheet includes links to five separate technology information sheets that discuss common mitigation technologies in greater detail. When we think of passive mitigation, we usually think of passive barrier systems. and today we'll be discussing the three most common varieties of passive barrier systems. These include asphalt latex membranes, thermoplastic membranes, and composite membranes. And there are subtle differences between these types of passive barrier systems, such as the materials used and the installation methods employed, but they all seal the building foundation and block vapor intrusion pathways. Ultimately, the site conditions should drive the selection for which type of passive barrier system you use. As someone who sees a lot of mitigation system designs, I can tell you that evaluating these systems can be a little confusing at times. So I want to encourage each of you to engage with your mitigation system vendors when evaluating which products are best suited for your site conditions, as well as your regulatory contacts to understand any regulatory requirements and documentation needs when assessing your mitigation options. Now we'll cover asphalt latex membranes. These systems consist of a base layer, an asphalt latex core, and a cap sheet. The materials used in the base layer and cap sheet can vary, but they usually consist of a thin plastic membrane backed with a geotextile fabric. The base layer provides a surface for the spray-applied asphalt latex to adhere to, and the cap provides protection to the barrier system. The core of the asphalt latex membrane is spray-applied and it cures in place, which provides a seamless layer of protection. The cap sheet creates a bond between the barrier and the concrete slab, and that bond eliminates the need for mechanical fasteners and sealing around penetrations. The overall thickness of the asphalt latex membrane measured in mils will be specified by the product manufacturer. Next, we'll discuss thermoplastic membranes. These are typically single-layered systems comprised of high-density polyethylene, but they may consist of a variety of other materials. When compared to other types of barrier systems, thermoplastic membranes are thicker and they're more rigid. That additional thickness affects the installation procedures and it differentiates thermoplastic membranes from common moisture or vapor barriers intended solely for waterproofing applications. During the installation process, the sheets of thermoplastic membrane are overlapped and the seams are heat welded. Prefabricated boots are used to seal around utility penetrations and other penetrations, and mechanical fasteners are used to secure terminations. This type of passive barrier system is often used in conjunction with a vapor collection system. The photo on the right of this slide was taken during the installation of a prefabricated boot used to seal around a pipe penetration. Due to the thickness of thermoplastic membranes, they're more puncture resistant and they offer a high level of chemical resistance. The material costs are low, but the installation process is more labor intensive. These types of barriers are typically used in new construction applications. The last type of passive barrier system we'll discuss are composite membranes, which use a variety of materials to create a multi-layered system. The materials used can improve chemical resistance, constructability, and durability. And we like to say that the sum of the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And by this, we mean that multiple layers may provide greater protection when they're used in combination with one another versus being used on an individual basis. There is some gray area between composite membranes and other types of barriers. For example, composite membranes and asphalt latex membranes both use multiple materials that can diffuse, that can reduce diffusion rates and prevent migration of contaminant vapors into the building envelope. And this example highlights the need to understand which materials are most appropriate to use based on your site conditions. Depending on the combination of materials used, composite membranes may offer greater protection using thinner mill systems compared to other types of barrier systems. The installation methods will vary depending on which materials are used. And one thing to note is that some barrier systems incorporate tape-based seams that may be subject to delamination. So, if smooth materials are used, they may pose installation challenges due to lack of adhesion to the concrete slab. As with any mitigation technology, always be sure to follow all of the manufacturer's instructions. I can't stress this enough. Diligently following the manufacturer's installation instructions and thoroughly documenting the installation process can help you achieve regulatory compliance goals more efficiently. When considering which type of pass barrier system is right for your site, keep in mind that some states require minimum mill thicknesses, and regulatory approvals may be required for newer technologies. More details about the asphalt latex membranes, thermoplastic membranes, and composite membranes are provided in the passive barrier system technology information sheet. While use of passive barrier systems is the most common form of passive mitigation, there are other approaches that also provide protection against a wide variety of contaminants. And these include mitigation technologies such as aerated floors, passive subslab venting systems, epoxy floor coatings, and building designs such as raised foundations or vented crawl spaces. Let's start with aerated floor avoid space systems. This type of system uses plastic forms installed prior to pouring the concrete floor slab. And once the concrete floor slab is poured, the form creates a void space beneath the floor, as opposed to other types of systems that use a permeable layer of sand or gravel. There is very low resistance to airflow within the void space because these types of systems don't have to pull vapors through a layer of sand or gravel. And this allows for higher air exchange rates beneath the floor compared to other types of venting systems. The plastic forms are connected to vertical vent risers, which allow vapors from the void space to be discharged at locations above the roof of the building. And while aerated floors can rely on passive venting, these systems are often use active means to depressurize the void space. So to summarize this mitigation technology, there is very low resistance to airflow using aerated floors versus other types of venting systems, and these can result in lower operating costs overall. However, there may be less applicable to retrofitting existing buildings rather than use in newly constructed buildings unless higher floor elevations can be accommodated within those existing buildings. Next, we'll move on to passive subslab venting systems. These types of systems consist of a permeable layer of sand or gravel beneath the floor slab. Horizontal vent piping, which typically consists of perforated PVC pipe or permeable geotextile matting, is installed within the permeable layer. The horizontal vent piping is connected to vertical vent risers that extend above the roof of the building. Vapors beneath the building that migrate through the permeable layer are captured within the horizontal vent piping, and they're routed through the vertical vent risers where they're ultimately discharged above the roof of the building. This type of venting system relies on pressure differences to generate flow through the piping network. They're almost always used in combination with a passive barrier. The photo on the slide shows a passive subslab venting system, and you can see that gravel is used to create a permeable layer. Permeable venting layer. The horizontal venting pipe, or in this photo is labeled the collection network, is installed within the permeable gravel layer. The void space, or collection plenum, is shown where the horizontal vent piping connects to the vertical vent risers. A vertical vent riser or exhaust vent is connected to the collection plenum. And the exhaust vent in this photo is capped during the building construction phase, but it will ultimately be extended to terminate above the roof of the building. Under the right conditions, a passive subslab venting system can capture vapors over a large area, and their simple design avoids the need for intensive operation, maintenance, and monitoring after the system is installed. However, when compared to an active venting system, a passive subslab venting system may require a greater number of vent risers and it may have reduced performance in some applications. The key here is to understand your mitigation needs based on your site conditions. I'm going to reiterate that passive venting is almost always used in combination with a passive barrier, and some state regulatory agencies may not allow for passive subsleb venting as a standalone mitigation option. So please be mindful of applicable regulatory requirements when preparing the design of a passive vapor mitigation system. So, what happens if you have an existing structure and you want to use a passive mitigation approach? In those situations, an epoxy floor coating can be applied to an existing floor slab. The condition of the floor slab and the surface preparation can affect the overall quality of the epoxy floor coating application. The concrete must be clean and dry, and the surface must be scarified for the epoxy floor coating to bond properly. Epoxy floor coatings can provide a strong, durable, chemical-resistant barrier. They can be installed in a variety of building types, and they're easy to clean and maintain. And since they're installed on the top of the concrete floor slab, damage to the floor coating is easy to identify and repair. They're also easy to customize. They are offered in a variety of colors and finishes to meet aesthetic and functional needs, such as a slip-resistant finish. However, they require some special preparation of the concrete to control moisture content and prevent delamination, and as well as scarification of the concrete to ensure a strong bond with the concrete surface. Like any type of system, an operation, maintenance, and monitoring plan needs to be established and implemented to address any damages to the epoxy floor coating after it's installed. The last category of passive mitigation we'll discuss is building design. The design of a structure can be used to prevent vapor intrusion from occurring or mitigate vapor intrusion risks. For example, parking garages are usually constructed in city settings where space is limited. They're designed to prevent the buildup of vehicle exhaust by increasing the air exchange rate within the parking structure. In some locations, air exchange rates are specified by building code. And in these cases, documenting that required air exchange rates are being maintained may be sufficient to address vapor intrusion risks for the parking structure. Other forms of building design, such as raised foundations and vented crawl spaces, can address vapor intrusion concerns for smaller buildings. Raised foundations are usually found in warm climates and areas prone to flooding. The use of block and beam or podium-style construction to raise buildings off the ground separates the building from the vapor source and cuts off the vapor intrusion pathway. But more often, you'll find houses with crawl spaces rather than raised foundations. The concept used in the parking garage example is the same for buildings with vented crawl spaces, just on a smaller scale. Increasing the air exchange rates within the crawl space can help to prevent buildup of unwanted vapors. This can be achieved using natural ventilation or by incorporating fans into the design if adequate air exchange rates cannot be met. More information about building design can be found in the Building Design Technology Information Sheet. Regardless of the mitigation approach you select, be sure to check with your state regulatory agency about any requirements when considering implementation of any of the passive mitigation approaches we've discussed today. Now it's time for a knowledge check. Which mitigation technology is commonly used in combination with a passive barrier system? Your options are A, aerated floors, B, epoxy floor coatings, C, passive subslab venting systems, or D, none of these. Take a moment to consider. Okay, it looks like the poll is closed. Yes, the best answer is C, passive subslab venting systems. That being said, please remember that there are a variety of mitigation technologies that can be used in combination with one another depending on the site conditions and your mitigation needs. Next, we'll discuss design and installation of the mitigation system. So at this point, I'll turn things over to Peter.
Thanks, Jay. We'll find out if my little pointer thing works. But at this point, we've already defined what passive mitigation is. We reviewed the five different types of passive technologies that you can use. One thing I just want to reiterate is that we've already consulted the CSM. We've used it as a tool to evaluate all of our site conditions, and we've concluded that we're moving forward with passive mitigation. So we're doing that with that assumption made. The next step is, now what? What are we going to do next? And in my experience, I've seen people do it a number of different ways. The first general option would be is that they try to figure it out as they go. So they're just kind of, going about their business, trying to figure out how to mitigate the vapors. I've seen instances where a general contractor will just get a letter from an environmental engineer and say, "Hey, you need to incorporate the system into your building." And the third option, which is obviously the preferred option and what we're going to talk about today, is they get site-specific plans that are developed to show and inform all parties how the mitigation system will be installed. So we're really going to focus on how to give you or talk about the best practices in the design, installation, and QA/QC of passive mitigation systems. ITRC has developed a number of different resources for you to review. And it should be noted that many of these design concepts we're discussing can also be applied to the previous active systems. So let's start where you can find out about a little bit more on the information. Maybe Jay, if you can, oops, how do I go back? There we go. All right. So ITRC team has created three separate design process fact sheets for to help with the implementation of these systems. These design consideration fact sheets summarize the key items that might be needed to take that you might need to take into account when a mitigation system is implemented, and they'll also help you address the entire process. So they really cover from design, post-installation, as well as OM&M and exit strategies. Right now, we're going to be covering the design process fact sheet. The other fact sheets, the OM&M and the post-installation, will be followed our presentation or our section in the next module. The design process considerations fact sheet is a reference document that I'd really like to point you to. It really gets into more of the nuts and bolts that we really don't have time to cover in this presentation. It's really important when you're beginning your VMS or VIMS design to establish the basis of design. Basically, how did you arrive at the conclusion that a passive system is most appropriate? A design basis document first needs to explain how vapor intrusion is occurring based on the CSM, and there should also be an explanation to include what technology you've selected and how the selected technology, or in some cases, technologies, will meet the mitigation objectives. So next, let's review kind of the cornerstone of successful implementation, and that's developing a set of plans that reflects the basis of design. It shows all the different aspects of the mitigation approach. These VIMS plans should also contain product specifications, job-specific detail drawings, as well as QA/QC guidelines. I do get this question a lot, and that is, why do I need to do this? And really, the reason why you need to do it is because whether you're going active or passive, these systems need to be incorporated into a building. And in order to create, or I'm sorry, in order to implement these systems effectively, a lot of different construction trades are involved. Construction, in my mind, and I'm always curious how some of these buildings stand up, is really organized chaos. And all these trades that are responsible for the implementation need really explicit instructions on what to do. In order to provide this explicit instructions to the team, these plans will show the detailed drawings of how and where the system will be installed. That's fairly basic. The one that really trips people up is when they also incorporate a venting system as well, because they need to know exact placement of vent placement, vent risers, and monitoring points so they can incorporate them properly into the building. With performance testing, it can mean many things. But for example, when we talk about passive barriers, a diffusion coefficient is a good performance metric. Diffusion coefficients can be a good indicators of a product ability to be protective against chemicals of concern and should be included with the mitigation system design documentation. So, system installation planning. Kelly touched on this in the beginning of the presentation. And once your design is complete and they're getting ready to start the implementation of the system, the VIMS designer should confirm that a pre-construction meeting is being planned with all trades involved in the installation of the system. This should include the VIMS designer, product manufacturers, in some case regulators, specialty installers, but most importantly, it needs to involve the rest of the project team. So the general contractor, concrete and rebar installers, plumbers, electrical contractors, architects, anyone that's going to be involved with this system needs to know. There could be a, I could do a blooper reel of all the interesting things that we've seen on site over the years, but it really starts the process in the right, on the right foot if you can get all these people in one room and describe what's going on. In a formal pre-con, they will review the site conditions prior to installation. This means that they'll review the plans and they'll also look at it as it relates to the actual site conditions. Many times after, between the when the plans are developed and when they actually go to construction, site conditions can change. They can change methods of construction. There's been cases where they'll find an unmarked UST site, UST on site. There's all sorts of different things that can pop up, and it's important that those are coordinated. In addition to covering the conditions, they need to review substrate requirements, ventilation layout, locations of vent risers, utility penetrations, and overall construction sequencing. QA/QC procedures are, one of the most important things that can be done. And it's really important that those expectations are outlined during the pre-construction meeting. They need to agree upon frequency and duration of the installation oversight. And they need to make sure that this is maintained during the construction process. You hear instances where, the inspector wasn't called out at the proper time. That's one of the reasons why they have these meetings, is to make sure everyone knows the rules moving forward. At the end of the meeting, the general contractor and the other trades should be clear on what's needed to install a system correctly, as well as the sequence for how the installation will progress. Taking time to conduct this meeting will dramatically increase the likelihood that the system is installed in accordance with the mitigation plans. So QA/QC is, as we just mentioned, is one of the most important aspects with passive approaches. These should be selected during the design phase. So again, as it gets to from the design phase to the pre-installation phase, everybody knows what's expected. There's a lot of sources for QA/QC guidelines. This include manufacturer's requirements, regulatory requirements, as well as site-specific needs. You mentioned those sites with high groundwater tables. That's a whole different approach that you need to take. Some of the more common ways to verify system installation include smoke or tracer gas testing, coupon sampling, oversight documentation. Oversight documentation is probably the most important thing you can do during this process. It gives you that formal record what has occurred. If something happens in the future, if documented properly, you should be able to go through and help figure out what the issue is. And with passive barriers, they're constructed in the field. And prior to the placement of concrete slabs, each barrier system should have insulation specifications along with those quality control procedures to test the integrity of the seams, seals around pipe penetration, system termination points, and overall membrane integrity. One of the things that we always stress is to do an inspection prior to the placement of concrete, because you can go through this entire process, and there can be damage of trades prior to the placement of concrete. A good example of if you're wondering what a smoke test looks like is in this picture here to the right. There's a smoke machine. They pump the smoke underneath the membrane. It's non-toxic, but what it does is it can help identify deficiencies in the system that you wouldn't be able to recognize just using your regular eyes. So design considerations, there's a big difference between new and existing structures. And, where passive generally goes with new construction, it could also be incorporated with existing structures as well. The same is true with active systems. Really, the main differences between the two is with new construction, the system can be incorporated during the construction process. There's a lot more known when you're constructing a building than an existing building, where you really have to work around the existing building conditions, as well as probably do a little research into how that building was constructed. Obviously, for newer buildings, that's a little bit easier than some of the older buildings that are probably more likely to be retrofit today. It's important to note that in some situations, you might require rapid mitigation of the vapor intrusion pathway. ITRC has something for this. It's called the ITRC Rapid Response and Ventilation Fact Sheet. So if those conditions arise, we would advise you to check out that fact sheet. With new construction, again, it provides a clean slate and makes it easier to properly evaluate and plan for the implementation of a VIM system. Regardless of what type of system is utilized, planning, construction, oversight, as we stated already repeatedly, is a very important step in this process and really required to make sure that these are installed per designs. The planning and resulting VIMS design should be used to help coordinate with the project team and subsequent trades. The design should also be part of the building plans to aid in managing the system in the future. This is something that comes up a lot more, probably in the last 4 or 5 years, is that people construct these buildings. They want to sell a building. New buyers want to make sure that they have done everything that they've said they were going to do. And again, having that documentation is really important, not only for troubleshooting, but also for that building's history moving forward. Again, the key advantage with new construction is the ability to design the passive mitigation system around the building itself or within the building itself, and you can also create redundancy. With existing structures, again, you just don't have the flexibility that comes with new construction. It's, again, more challenging due to the fact that the building already exists. That really might limit what passive technologies you can implement on the site. The key consideration for incorporating a mitigation system is having a good understanding of the existing foundation and how it's going to impact your design. You always see these stories at various VI talks where building modifications, where they've tried to implement a mitigation system, and then they've, through the discovery process, found that the building's been modified over the years. That can impact the effectiveness of the system. Ideally, they had the original plans so they can see exactly what happened. That's another reason why you're doing these systems, to create as-built drawings. So if something does change, that again gets incorporated into the building paperwork. But at the end of the day, a building's in place, and it's going to take probably considerable time to understand how the building foundation might impact the mitigation system. And really, again, this is leaned or more of an approach for an active type system. Regardless if you go passive or active, the VIMS plan should be documented on how should document how these systems were installed. So now we're at a knowledge check. What is the most important element of a good design? A, figuring it out as you go. B, skipping the CSM. C, letting the project team know you want a passive mitigation. Or D, proper site evaluation and planning. So far with these, everyone's gotten this question Pretty much correct. I think we wanted to throw an easy one in there for everyone. And let's see what the results are. Yeah, 98%. So it sounds like, we might have had some jokers in there, but for the most part, everyone got the right answer. So what did we learn during this module? We learned a number of things. If I can get this slide to advance. There we go. Ah, D, C. Proper, that's the answer. Oh, sorry, I skipped ahead. So to aid you further again, please check out the design considerations fact sheet. There's a system design and documentation checklist as well. That checklist is basically provides more information on the pre-system installation process. It's really designed to help you think. So, I mean, not everything is going to apply to the project that you're working on, but really it's a great place to start to help you review the many aspects of passive mitigation. So, what did we learn in this module? Again, we learned a number of things. We defined passive mitigation and really how that differentiates from active mitigation, the use of electricity. We talked about the five major categories of passive mitigation systems: passive barriers, aerated floors, passive subslab venting, epoxy floor coatings, and building design. We also discussed the key elements of BIM's design and how planning is crucial to its success. And finally, the importance of the construction quality assurance installation and oversight process. Mitigation systems are installed for a reason, and it's important that you get it right the first time. So what's next? We'll be going into the OM&M and exit strategies component of this training module. So a lot more to come. Thank you for your time, and I guess we're ready for questions. Ah, sorry. Need one more slide, quick.
Thank you so much, Jay and Peter. We're going to open it up for our second question and answer session. At any time, you can type your questions into the Q&A pod in the bottom of your screen. And just as we did before, we're going to try to get through as many of those questions as we can. It looks like we already have quite a few, so we're just going to jump right into it. Our first question here is, what type of provout do you want to see to demonstrate passive VMS are functioning properly?
I can take that question. I think I saw a few questions about coupon sampling, and I want to give maybe Peter a chance to kind of talk about what that is, because I think it would tie in nicely to the prove out discussion.
Oh,
I think the question was, can you explain what coupon sampling is and maybe what purpose it serves?
yeah. So that is for a specific type of, that would be more for a composite barrier. Basically, anytime that you have a spray-on membrane going down, what they'll do to verify the thickness, that the proper thickness has been applied, is they'll cut a coupon. The way I train, it's either a triangle or a square, and then they'll measure to make sure that the proper mill thickness has been applied. That's one of the common protocols that's used in a composite barrier application, or a spray. Let me make it more general, in a spray barrier technology, spray barrier approach.
So I think that ties into prove out. There's a number of things we kind of touched on during this presentation. The oversight documentation is really important when you're doing a passive barrier type of application. You really want to document the integrity, the structural integrity, and the tightness of that barrier. So things like proper installation are key to document. Peter talked about things like smoke testing to verify that. So that's one method of checking for any leaks and making sure things are vapor tight, and then sealing up, you know, if there's any places you have to reapply, like some pinhole leaks or somewhere around utility penetrations or that kind of thing, making sure that it's vapor tight. It kind of depends a little bit on what type of a barrier you would use or system you use. As far as the venting component goes, I can only really speak from my experience in the state of Michigan as a regulator, but we're looking for evidence of flow through the venting system. One thing we've talked about is kind of measuring flow, like at 2 points in the vent riser, like the base of the vent riser, to see if there's flow there, and also towards the top or the middle of the vent riser. You could do something like maybe like a in, inject some smoke. Sometimes that works, sometimes it's a little problematic, or do like a tracer test, or just evidence of some kind of airflow through that venting system. So it really depends on what components you're installing, but each of those components, like the essentially sealing off the slab using your membrane, as well as the venting layer, you want to prove those out and show that they're functioning as designed.
Hey, this is Kelly here. I just wanted to add in as well for the prove out. We'll talk about it, I think, in the next section. But the last component I would say of that too is about some of the analytical testing confirmation. You know, it could be sub slab and or air, depending on your requirements there. But that could be part of the last steps to really ensure that the things you did were implemented correctly and protective.
All right, well, thank you all for tackling that first question to, or first two questions, I guess, to kick us off for this second Q&A session. We're just going to keep moving through our questions, try to get to as many as we can. So it looks like our next one is, what is the rule of thumb for placement of exhaust stacks on roofs from other infrastructure on roofs, either HVAC intakes or other penetrations like rainwater leaders?
Yeah, I think Rachel answered this question and touched on this with active mitigation systems. ANSI ARST has some standards for distances from the exhaust or discharge point of a vapor mitigation system to anywhere where there's openings like windows, doors, occupiable spaces, HVAC intakes. You know, the main idea is to get enough separation distance so that you don't get what we call re-entrainment, which would be essentially you vent vapors out of the building and then somehow they get brought back into the building. So that's the idea there, is just to have enough distance so that doesn't happen.
Yeah, the
Yeah,
city of
one thing.
LA has it outlined in their methane mitigation guidance, and I think we actually have it in this too. I think it's in a checklist or, you know, somewhere where we say, you know, exhaust can't be within any air takes or air intakes and windows. I could be wrong.
I think you might be right, Peter. That might be in the active portion. But just something to point out with passive systems, a lot of times we'll put wind turbines on them, or some people call them whirlybirds. But when those things are spinning, they're actually spitting those vapors out horizontally. And so that can be something that we should really be thinking about when we're spacing, right? Because normally we're venting vertically with our active systems. And that again is a recommendation that comes with ANSI ARS, is to discharge vertically. But when we start discharging sideways, there are some guidances in there as well that talk to that speak to that, where you're have direct distance measurements from certain intakes. So there's a lot of actually different situations that are mapped out in the ANSI ARS guidance that talk about all those different situations. But definitely be thinking about whether you're venting horizontally with those whirlybirds.
I will say, you know, whenever I look at a vapor mitigation design, whether it's active or passive, that's something I always look at. It's one of the first things I look at. It's one of the, I'm not going to say it's for everybody, but sometimes people just fail to pay attention to that.
Thank you again. Moving on, our next question is, in a situation where the water table is at the base of the concrete slab and sumps are used to keep a rarely occupied basement dry, would pressurization and venting of the basement be a possible or alternative to keep vapors from entering the floor above?
You know,
Oh.
there's when it comes to high water table, I think from a passive standpoint, you may have two options. One might be an epoxy floor coating, but you have to be careful about that because if there's a lot of moisture in the concrete, that can cause delamination issues. Essentially, the coating will peel off the concrete over time. The other thing you could do is like an aerated floor. Essentially, you're creating like a false floor. I've seen that both in new construction and retrofitting applications. It's possible. It's not as common. And Rachel mentioned dewatering. I mean, that's always an option. I think it just depends on your site and what makes the most sense.
Yeah, the challenge with dewatering, it's much like you would face with an active system, right? It has to be on and operational. I've seen a lot of dewatering sites where they're supposed to be continually dewatering, and for whatever reason, the system's not working. It's not designed accurately, adequately for the site conditions, or they just turn it off or it's broken. So, when you deal with water, it makes things a lot more complicated. The biggest challenge with a coating is, like Jay said, is the moisture, and it can be done. It's probably, I'm going to venture to say, probably the most expensive thing to do properly, because you're worried about delamination of that coating.
Again, looks like we probably have time for about two more questions right now. So our next question is, how long does a membrane last?
Functional life of the building. That's my answer. I mean, it's these products are don't degrade easily, if at all. You know, there's projects where it's been used for 30 years at least. So, the last just as long, the functional design life of the building.
And then the last question that we have time for right now, are there any design manuals or resources for underground perf pipe layouts?
Oh, preferential. Let me see what.
I there are. City of LA is one. Rachel, I think ours might have some guidance, but it's always
Yeah,
going to be qualified for site specific.
they do. ANSI/ARS has some pretty good guidance on that actually. And it's really geared primarily towards an active system. But certainly you wouldn't want to space out any more than that. So it's a good starting point. And then if you wanted to for a passive system, maybe be a little more conservative, that would be a good starting point to look at.
All right. Well, thank you everybody for your questions. We will have one more opportunity to answer any more questions at the end of our class today. But remember, the Q&A pod will be there throughout this last section at any time for you to ask questions during this training. And our trainers are monitoring the Q&A pod during the presentation and answering questions that we haven't gotten to yet. So I'm going to now turn it over to Ellie Haddad to discuss system verification.
Good afternoon, everyone. I think it's a good afternoon for everyone. I'm Eli Haddad with Haley and Aldrich. So the last module today is taking the design from Rachel and Jay and Pete. How do we make sure that it is working according to specifications and according to expectations? So in the module, we will talk about using the ITRC document, to in your work. We'll talk about the significance of early communication, and then also the planning for decommissioning or discontinuing your mitigation system. At what point do we do that? We'll talk, of course, about the verification of the system and proper system performance and how to address underperformance. So that's what we'll cover in the next 15 minutes or so. And with that, I advanced it. Okay, so it's important to communicate with the stakeholders. Communication is key. And you will see this theme repeated during this module. You want to make your stakeholders informed, and stakeholders would include the regulators, the consultants, the property owners, the property tenants, responsible parties, and maybe others. We also want to select appropriate performance metrics that will give us the baseline reading, but then also that we can use for the subsequent inspections that we will do and the subsequent data that we are going to collect. Again, we want to communicate, we want to confirm acceptable scenarios for the shutdown of your system. For example, is the groundwater below screening levels? Have soil sources been removed, or are soil gas concentrations below screening levels? So it's important to document that throughout the process of the operation and maintenance. And the ITRC guidance provides you with post-installation fact sheet. You can consider it in testing for your O&M. It covers the active and passive systems. It also covers remediation and rapid response technologies. It describes the elements that you can use or you can consider during the construction. So I would recommend that you refer also to these helpful fact sheets. Now, verification is very important. And we do the verification during the construction. We do it right after the construction during the commissioning. And then we also do it after the system operates for the long term. So before we begin the confirmation testing, we do sometimes building survey, and we want to inspect our system. We want to make sure that the piping is still okay. We want to make sure, the risers are okay. We want to look at building conditions, compare pre-construction with the post-construction, and understand how those may affect our mitigation system. For example, if we have unsealed utility penetrations now, or incorrect piping that can decrease the effectiveness of the system, those are very important to inspect. And that baseline survey can be conducted during the design or pre-design phase, but then also can be done during the construction. And this is to compare what is happening post-construction versus pre-construction. So your systems are limited as to what is, if there are direct conduits, for example, that are not sealed. So it's important to do that verification. We also do that verification during the commissioning of the system. So after the construction, and we are now in the startup mode, there are a series of tests that we can do to make sure that it is operating properly and that it is meeting the mitigation objectives. For example, are we meeting the vacuum level criteria? Rachel talked about the different differential pressure that could that we want to exert across the building slab. So are those being are they being met, or do we have did we collect confirmation indoor air samples post startup to make sure that those indoor air samples show concentrations below the desired levels? We also, during the decommissioning or the commissioning, not decommissioning, during the commissioning, we want to make sure that we are operating in accordance with issued permits. So some permits would give you a threshold as to how much you can emit through the stacks. So are we meeting those building permits? And also, do we have we would follow that plan, do, check, adjust process. And we adjust the system as needed during the commissioning to make sure that the design, the target design parameters are being met. And of course, you know, some of these system verification details, Rachel, Pete, and Jay have already covered in the design. And then, of course, there are more information for the post installation in the checklist that ITRC provides. So documentation is critical. Sometimes we may have to develop as-built drawings post-construction because the construction could be different from the design, and some agencies may require documentation of those as-builts, or they could be required by permits. And then the verification performance data should be recorded, and they are typically submitted to regulatory agencies because they want to make sure that they are that the system is conforming with the design. It also gives us that baseline for comparison after the commissioning for the long-term O&M phase. So there are several performance metrics that you can collect. There is the vacuum field or pressure differential across the slab. We want to make sure that it meets that criteria of 0.02, let's say, or 0.01, whatever. That's something that you had to work with your with the agency. Pete and Jay talked about the smoke and tracer test testing. And then, of course, we can collect confirmation indoor air samples. There are also institutional controls that can be imposed. And the institutional control is not just about imposing them, but also monitoring that they are being followed. For example, if there's a deed restriction on the property and it gets sold, and the responsible party or the agency do not get informed, we want to make sure that this gets corrected. Why are they not being informed? So there is also a monitoring component for the institutional controls. Of course, we monitor the system vacuum, the airflow, and then many times the effluent concentration for permit requirements. And there are some other system and regulatory specific metrics that that we can follow. And you know, your the type of performance metrics is going to depend whether you have an active system, and sometimes it's a combination of these, sometimes it's one, but that's going to be something that would be determined in your design. There is a checklist in the ITRC guidance for post-installation system, and you have it for active system, passive system, and the templates. You know, you can choose it as a starting point, but it may change based on your state guidance. But here again, communication is very important. Documentation is very important to make sure that you that the system is performing correctly. So, Sarah is going to launch a knowledge check for us. What is the most important? What is it most important to develop verification procedure and an exit strategy? I hope nobody answers never. Okay. So the correct answer, let's see what we have. Most of you said during mitigation design and planning, and that is a correct answer. Some of you said during the VI investigation, we don't do it at that point because we still don't know what our design elements are going to be. So the verification procedures are going to depend on the design components, and then also the exit strategy is going to depend on the design components as well. So we do it during that period. So we're going to move on to the long-term O&M and then also the exit strategy. So first of all, when it comes to an exit strategy, it answers, so how long are we going to operate this? So there is a fact sheet with the ITRC guidance that talks about this. It provides a strategy for to make sure that we are conforming with the design specifications. It does give us, the fact sheet gives us a framework for an exit strategy on how to develop it. It does emphasize the early involvement of stakeholders because we want to make sure that they are involved early on in the process and get that buy-in from them. But there also could be some additional state-specific or system-specific requirements that go beyond what is specified in this fact sheet. So the long-term now O&M, what it addresses is whether or not in the long term. So we've done the verification during the construction, we've done it during the startup, and now it's operating. It's going to operate for the next few years. So there is going to be a process or a system that we want to make sure that it does operate according to design specifications. And then that data collection is going to assist us with that periodic system inspection and to make sure that we are measuring also those operational parameters. It also gives us the data that will make us assess on an ongoing basis the potential for implementing that exit strategy. So some of information also can be used to find out whether it's meeting the performance metrics and what we do if it's not. So we do analyze it to make sure or to understand what is the cause of some of the malfunctions. We want to make sure that the stakeholders are informed about these and how we are going to replace it. Some of the replacements, some typical things that happen with, let's say, the active system is, the fan may have to be replaced periodically. If you are treating the vapors through a carbon filtration system, that carbon needs to be replaced periodically. Sometimes these systems are equipped with alarm systems, and some of these sensors go bad, and you have to replace them. So there is ongoing malfunctioning typical that may happen. So it's very important to address those. But sometimes it goes beyond that. So you may want to consider upgrading the system. So if the fan is not giving us the desired differential pressure across the slab, we may want to upgrade the slab. Sometimes we may upgrade the fan, and sometimes we may want to add additional vapor intrusion mitigation systems if needed. So that data is always giving us that continuous feed in, again, planning, doing, checking and adjusting the system, and this case in the long term. Before there, they also mentioned that there are some additional things that you can use from the ITRC site. So this is an example from the CSM, and this information can also help us in the O&M process. And I'll click quickly through it. So this gives you the impact of certain design considerations on a different remedies. But this can also guide you in selecting what kind of O&M parameters you want to monitor for. Again, this is the same thing here. It gives you here for subslab soil type, it gives you the effect or the impact of this kind of parameter on the type of remedy. But in the long term, there are some checklists that you can use from the ITRC guidance that also gives you some additional information to make your own O&M checklist that is site specific to what your needs are. This quickly. So here's the O&M checklist from the ITRC guidance, and you have them ready. At least gives you a baseline for an active system, passive system, or even if it's going to be remediation. But again, you want to adjust this for your own site-specific needs. So the big question also comes as to when do you shut down the system? So you want to plan upfront. And I would ask that you refer to your to the active and passive mitigation modules for a discussion on the design process, the fact sheet, and then also the ITRC guidance on how to establish that framework. But all stakeholders should agree on the post-installation, on the monitoring, and on the termination procedure as part of your original design process. So as you collect your data, you want to continuously also evaluate the shutdown parameters. You know, what is it that would constitute that it's now time to shut down the system? After you see that some of the parameters are met, such as groundwater concentrations are below screening levels, because many times you have an ongoing groundwater remediation or soil remediation in conjunction with your vapor intrusion system. So if your soil gas concentrations are below screening levels or some certain parameters you reach that constitute a trigger to start shutting down your system. Sometimes you may say, I'm going to shut it down for 6 months, see if there's a rebound, and keep everything on standby, and then come back and revisit and collect the data. So that you want to determine that during your design process and in that exit strategy framework. But then also you want to, when it's time to shut down, how it will be decommissioned, what kind of documentation you have to provide. And also you want to consider that sometimes when it's going to take many years to clean up a formation, those systems may be operating for a long term. And I think it is time for a second knowledge check, which is the most important post-installation verification measure. There are many here. I think I gave you the answer before. All right, Sarah, give us the results. It depends. Half of you said it depends, and that is true. I would say all of the answers are correct, but it depends on what type of system that you install. So, if you're having so smoke tracer tests are you do that for mostly for the passive ventilation systems, indoor air samples you collect them if you have a pa if you install a passive ventilation system and then you want to do a verification or an active system, and sometimes it's a combination of these. I've seen in some of my cases where I have an active system where I have to do long-term institutional controls plus vacuum field readings, indoor air samples, and the system vacuum and airflow would be applicable for the active ventilation systems. We usually don't do that for the passive systems. So it depends for the most part on the remedy that or the mitigation system that you have chosen. So in summary, for the O&M, I would I want to emphasize a couple of things, the communication part of it, and then also that continuous do loop of the plan, do, check, and adjust mentality. In this module, we talked about thinking about the end in mind. Start with the end in mind, and then design your mitigation system, and then also your verification system based on that. We talked about the verification during commissioning of the system and the long-term monitoring. We also talked about exit strategy as to when would be appropriate to establish that, and then how to and when to start thinking about it, and how to design your verification program to also support your exit strategy. And I would leave you with these three questions when you are designing your verification program. Make sure that it answers whether or not your system is working after installation, if it's working in the long term, and if it is still needed. With that, Sarah, we can open it for questions about this module, and then also unanswered questions, I guess, for the previous modules.
Thank you, Ellie.
Let's see here. All right, so like Ellie said, we are going to have one final question and answer session right now. As I've said before, you can type your questions into the Q&A pod in the bottom of your screen, and we're going to try to get through as many questions as we can before we wrap things up for today. So we're just going to jump right into it. And actually, it looks like the two questions that we have in the question answer pod currently, we answered in the last Q&A session. So we'll just give it a minute to see if anybody has any questions. Please feel free to drop those in the Q&A pod now. We would be more than happy to answer any and all questions you have. So yeah, we'll just give it a moment and see if we have any questions come through.
So, Sarah, I feel like I answered everybody's questions on the verification program.
Yeah, that might just be the case. yeah, I'm not seeing any further questions. But I know Ellie, you were typing answers in the Q&A pod throughout our training today. So thank you so much for helping to answer our questions. But with that, I will just say thank you to all of our expert trainers for being here today and for their contribution to the ITRC document. We would love to hear back from all of our participants today, so please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that's linked on this final slide you're viewing now. Filling out the feedback form and certifying that you participated will allow you to receive a certificate of completion via email. And if you need any further clarification on the answers or would like to ask more questions, please email us at itrc@itrcweb.org. And we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. Other than that, have a great rest of your Thursday, and thank you so much for attending.